closely followed by the almost inaudible thuds of 5 more bullets ricocheting off that impregnable closed door. "Quick," shouts Amy, "before he gets the door open."
"He can't open it without the code," says Rosie. "He's in there for the long run."
As if to prove the point, very faint banging can now be heard from behind the door.
"That's good work, Rosie," says Amy.
"And without the upper body strength I used to have," says Rosie, as Amy gets to her feet.
"I sensed you doubted me."
"Well, I sensed you doubted me," says Amy. "Let's promise neither of us will do that again," says Rosie. "I hit him with an Oscar, you know,
and not a scratch on it."
"When did you win an Oscar?"
"Best Cinematography, 1974, says Rosie, showing Amy the Oscar. "Poker game."
"I need to get off the island," says Amy.
"I'd say that I do too," says Rosie. "I just attacked a hitman with an Academy Award. We'd better get you out of those handcuffs."
"I get the feeling you've said that a few times in your life," says Amy.
"I can't take you with me, Rosie. It's too dangerous."
"You have no choice," says Rosie.
"Come on, it'll be an adventure."
"Who else have you got on your side right now?"
"Another text from Steve."
"A heart?"
"Actually, not bad timing, Steve."
"What's the plan?" Rosie asks.
"I could visit the sheriff if I found the body," says Amy.
"You really should stay here until I can send help. Kevin can't get out."
"Someone is trying to have you killed," says Rosie.
"Yes, and Vasily Karpin is still trying to have you killed," says Amy.
"Listen," says Rosie.
"Sometimes a bit of attention is nice. But who's after you?"
"Fairbanks was found with a bag of money," says Amy.
"Almost $1 million, says Rosie. "And Jeff and I did a job a while ago for a man we really shouldn't have," says Amy. "A money smuggler called Francois Loubet."
"Ah," says Rosie. "Nice guy? Single?"
"Never met him," says Amy. "All over encrypted messages. But if he's after me, for whatever reason, I'm in real trouble. And Jeff's in real trouble too."
"And he knows where we are?" says Rosie.
"If it's him," says Amy.
"Sounds like you shouldn't leave me here on my own, then."
Amy doesn't have an answer to that.
"Good," says Rosie.
"Now, why don't you load up on coffee and ammunition while I go to pack my things?"
Chapter 16.
Jeff Nolan declines the Parmesan.
"You know me and Parmesan, Bruno."
Bruno gives a slight bow to acknowledge the fact that he does indeed know Jeff and Parmesan. And Jeff returns to his files. The recent ones, of course, but also some much older. Jeff does not intend to lose his business. He knows that such things are sent to try us, and he is nothing if not a patient man. Jeff always eats alone if he can help it. Sometimes there are clients to be entertained or impressed or mollified, and Susan Knox will book him into whichever restaurant is the hardest to get into that week. But usually he is at Bruno's. It feels like home. Jeff started working in the city at 17, was making a bit of money by 18, and was making a lot of money by 21. Bought a house in Sevenoaks when he was 24, bought a bigger one 2 streets away at 26, then at 28, bought a townhouse in Mayfair for $9 million. He can see it across the street, through the windows of Bruno's. Jeff likes to take care of details. That's what brought him into the close protection business in the first place. He'd been doing a deal with a Saudi prince and seen one of his security details smoking and reading the paper. Jeff asked what the Saudi prince paid for his security and whether he was happy with the job they did. The sum of money the prince mentioned and the shrug he gave told Jeff that this could be the business for him. He was 35 at this point and ready to retire, so it was perfect. Jeff is rereading the reply he received from Francois Loubet after that first email, before the killing started. Again, it might be evidence one of these days.
"Mr. Nolan, thank you for your email dated 14th of April. I'm sorry to hear of your client's plight. I don't imagine jail is fun for anyone,"
However, it is the only proper punishment for smuggling money into a foreign country. We have laws for a reason. As to your suggestion that I am somehow involved, well, I couldn't possibly comment. I will say, however, that I am a legitimate businessman with many interests worldwide, and my bookkeeping and tax records are, while private, exemplary. I hope nothing unfortunate should befall your company or any more of your clients in the months ahead, but if it does, might I suggest it is karma for the allegations you have made against me? Meanwhile, you might do well to speak to your colleague, Joe Blow. Proceed carefully, Mr. Nolan. Warmest regards, François Loubet. A clear and present threat from Loubet. No arguing with that. And the very first mention of Joe Blow. Bruno has returned to top up Jeff's glass. Jeff holds his hand flat to indicate enough. And hears a noise from the street. A squeal of tyres. Not the sound of a car braking, but the sound of a car suddenly speeding up. And so it is that Jeff has already started sprinting before the black Jeep crashes its way through the front windows of the restaurant. By the time the two figures in balaclavas have leapt from the front seats brandishing pistols, Jeff is already through the swinging double doors that lead to the kitchen. And by the time the men follow him through the doors, firing wildly, Jeff is gone. Through the fire door and into the back streets of Mayfair. Chapter 17. Well, 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 Rosie D'Antonio is thinking, this day is certainly looking up. Rosie hadn't liked the death threats from Vasily Karpin, the chemicals billionaire. Of course she hadn't. But these things come with the territory. If you have any sort of personality, someone will eventually want to kill you. And she shouldn't have done it, really. She should have hidden Vasily Karpin's identity. But she was bored. And when you're bored, it's important to make things happen. Which is also why she is now in a speedboat, water lapping around her Louboutins, helping a fugitive solve a murder. Not the most extraordinary Friday of her life, but not a bad one. Things used to happen to Rosie all the time. So many things. Parties, affairs, book launches, premieres, new deals, new lovers, tiffs, spats, beefs, kisses in swimming pools, photographers in bushes, lawsuits, rehabs, husbands, cocaine on yachts, cocaine on rooftops, cocaine at the White House. Mustique, London, Capri, Aspen. Trouble and fun and trouble. But people die, or worse, get married. People slow down. The photographers hide in other people's bushes now. They hide, Rosie guesses, in Taylor Swift's bushes. There is still romance. There's still booze. Still the odd party here and there. People as old as she is clinking glasses and remembering who they all once were. And there's still the writing, which people seem to be enjoying again. Back on the bestseller lists. She was never in any danger of running out of money, but she had been in danger of running out of acclaim, of running out of fame, the sparkling tonic she has long been able to add to the neat gin of her private life. All in all, Rosie is quite happy to be in the boat. If you told her at 40 that she'd still be doing this sort of thing many years later, she would have been very happy. And how nice to spend a bit of quality time with this charming young bruiser, Amy, who is currently squatting, bailing water out of the leaky hull. Rosie only really has one rule in life. If you see a door, walk through it. The mainland is just a thin, misty smudge, while the water in the speedboat is halfway up Rosie's calves. But Rosie chooses to remain confident. The boat, leaky though it might be, is so fast that, by the time it is ready to sink, they will have reached the mainland. "Why don't you get a speedboat that doesn't leak?" Amy asks, above the noisy row between the engine and the ocean. "Sentimental value," yells Rosie. "When I got my first ever $1 million royalty check for Tick-Tock Death O'Clock, I think, I bought a house and that burned down. Then I bought a diamond ring, and my husband gave that to a Romanian gymnast. So I bought a racehorse, and I bought this speedboat." "What happened to the racehorse?" Don't ask. Mafia. It's taking on a lot of water, says Amy.
That's life, says Amy.
We take on a lot of water. The trick is to keep moving.
Rosie recognizes that keeping moving is Amy's only option for now. She is happy to join her. After all, someone is trying to kill them both. Not the same someone, she assumes, but you never know. Visiting Justin Scroggy, the sheriff, was the best of their currently limited options. He had been at the crime scene, presumably searched it, maybe even had a theory or two. The presence of the famous Rosie D'Antonio and the power of her credit card might be enticing for a small-town sheriff. Fine by Rosie. Nice to be needed.
I think this is a losing battle, Amy says, still desperately bailing.
Rosie looks over to the land.
We'll be okay. Let's swim the last bit. The sharks never come this close to the shore. And can you carry my case on your back?
I'm not as young as I once was.
Chapter 18.
Is she clutch cable? Says Tony Taylor from underneath the bonnet of Steve's car. Nice and simple. Steve nods.
What do you need to do?
I need to replace your broken clutch cable with a new clutch cable, says Tony. If that's not too technical for you.
Tony unfolds himself and stands up straight. He wipes his hands on a rag that is slightly dirtier than his hands.
I'll have it done in 20 minutes. If you want to take a look at my bins?
Deal, says Steve.
I'm thinking of driving up to Letchworth Garden City, if you fancy a day out.
Letchworth Garden City, says Tony.
What's there?
Just always fancied visiting, says Steve.
Tony nods.
How long are you planning to spend there?
Couple of hours, says Steve.
Three at the most.
Now Tony shakes his head.
Nope.
Not going to work, Stevie. Think it through.
Steve cocks his head. He's happy to be dissuaded. Experience tells him you get so much more visiting someone in person, but he's not really investigating anything anyway. He could just send Vivid Viral an email.
It's a good 2.5 hours with those roadworks, says Tony, opening various workshop drawers. A31, M27, come off at Junction 4 for the M3, M25 up to St Albans, cross-country to the A1. Hell of a trip.
Yeah, says Steve, 5 hour round trip.
5 hour round trip. So even if you're only there for 2 hours,
you're going to hit rush hour one way or the other,
says Tony, emerging with what Steve hopes and assumes is a clutch cable for a Vauxhall Corsa.
Rather you than me.
When Tony is right, he's right.
Just send them an email.
Or leave it all together, maybe. You don't have to play with every ball of string that comes your way. Time to take a look at those recycling bins. They both turn at the sound of a knock on Tony's open garage door. A man is poking his head around.
Sorry to disturb you, gents. Which one of you is Steve Wheeler?
Who's asking? Says Steve.
The man, a tall, good-looking black guy, very nice coat, walks into the garage and extends his hand.
Jeff Nolan. I wonder if I might have a word.
Jeff Nolan, Amy's boss?
Asks Steve in a sudden panic. Where is she?
Nothing to worry about, Steve, says Jeff quickly.
Sorry, I shouldn't have surprised you like this. I should have thought.
I just need a favour.
You've come down from London? Asks Steve. To see me?
I have, says Jeff.
Your address is in Amy's file. Your neighbour told me you'd be here.
Where in London? Tony asks.
Mayfair, says Jeff.
Tony nods.
Did you go down through Brixton, M3 and across?
North Circular, M4, says Jeff.
That's a long route, says Tony.
I was concerned I was being followed by a hitman, says Jeff, so it was a safer route.
Tony nods again.
Well, yeah, I mean...
That a clutch cable for a Vauxhall Corsa?
Tony looks at the clutch cable.
You know your clutch cables, my friend.
I read a lot, says Jeff.
Always have. Shakespeare, encyclopedias, car manuals.
If you like clutch cable, Steve steps in.
Does Amy know you're here?
Jeff shakes his head.
I'll explain it all. Can you meet me in an hour, somewhere private?
Jeff looks over at Tony.
No offence.
I never take offence, says Tony. Saved me a lot of time over the years.
Sure, says Steve to Jeff. Amy likes Jeff, trusts him. So Steve does too. That'll give me time to get my clutch cable fixed.
And look at my bins, says Tony.
And look at Tony's bins, agrees Steve.
You might find the pace of things down here a bit slow, Jeff.
Suits me fine at the moment, says Jeff.
There's a campsite called Holland's Wood, do you know it?
Out by Brockenhurst, yeah, I know it, says Steve.
Meet me there in an hour, says Jeff.
Pitch 46.
It's tucked away out of sight.
And Amy's okay, says Steve.
Amy's fine, says Jeff. That's a promise. I'm just running out of people I can trust. So I'm turning to someone Amy trusts.
Doesn't involve murders, does it? Says Steve.
Holland's Wood in an hour, says Jeff, without answering Steve's question. I'll reveal all.
B3055, then A337, says Tony. Glad to be of some help.
Chapter 19.
Nice house, says Amy. Squatting in a bush for an hour is a good workout. Rosie is curled up, using a Louis Vuitton suitcase as a pillow.
Too nice, says Rosie.
You don't think cops should live in nice houses? Amy asks.
I don't think they can afford to live in houses this nice, says Rosie.
Not this nice.
Criminals live on this street. Cops live one street over.
Perhaps he won the lottery.
Rosie had been all for heading straight up to Scroggy's front door, giving it a rat-a-tat-tat and taking their chances. Amy understands that. By and large, people liked to talk to Rosie. If you found her at your front door, you'd invite her straight in. But Amy doesn't always trust law enforcement officers, so it pays to be careful. They can get information from Scroggy without talking to the man. Get any information that might help, then try to head back to London and the safety of Jeff Nolan by any means possible. The key is to stay as low profile as possible for the next few days. If Lube paid Kevin to kill Amy, he will presumably still want Amy dead. And they are hardly inconspicuous, as she had pointed out to Rosie. Rosie accepted this. She was, for instance, wearing a tiara.
Always dressed to impress. It doesn't matter where you are.
If Scroggy was investigating the Fairbanks death, Amy knew she might find something to her advantage in his house.
Cops bring files home. The only alternative was breaking into police headquarters and, while Rosie was game, Amy told her she had tried that before, in Venezuela, and advised against it. In the time they'd been there, there had been no movement from the house. No noise, no lights, no deliveries. Amy looks at Rosie and nods.
Okay, it's empty, let's go.
Amy runs in a low crouch, while Rosie saunters along behind her. They skirt around the side and then the back of the Scroggy home.
Do you know how to pick lock?
Rosie's question is interrupted by Amy taking a large rock and smashing one of Scroggy's back windows.
Ah, I see you do.
Amy clears the remaining broken glass from the window frame and climbs inside. She then offers a hand to Rosie, who refuses it.
I didn't get where I am without being flexible, Rosie says, squeezing herself onto Justin Scroggy's kitchen worktop.
What are we looking for?
Computer or phone, says Amy. You check down here and I'll check upstairs.
Amy takes the stairs three at a time. The house is very nice. Rosie had been right. Too nice. Amy gets the feeling that whoever is paying Justin Scroggy, it isn't just the Lowest Port Police Department. She notices that Scroggy has a top-of-the-range Peloton bike, currently being used as a clothes airer. Amy has never understood why people cycle indoors. It's the same with boxing. Why punch bags when you can punch other people and stop them from punching you back? People are so weird.
Found it,
Rosie calls from downstairs, and Amy descends again. They're going to have to be quick. Who knows when Scroggy will be back? Amy isn't worried about escaping. She can escape from anywhere, but she doesn't want Scroggy to know she's been there. Doesn't want him to know that she's investigating the Fairbanks murder.
Her plan is simple. Find something that might make some sense of what's happening, then escape, unnoticed.
Where was it? Amy asks Rosie from the hallway.
In here, says Rosie from a den off the hallway.
Amy heads through the door to see Rosie proudly pointing at a computer.
Good work, says Amy.
Thanks, says Rosie, then cocks her thumb over her shoulder.
I spotted it straight after I saw his dead body.
Amy's eyes follow Rosie's thumb to the other side of the den, where the body of Sheriff Justin Scroggy is hanging by his bound hands from a ceiling joist. Amy looks back at Rosie.
I'm a writer, says Rosie. I notice things.
Chapter 20.
Jeff is speeding down back roads, away from the cameras. He has to get rid of his phone, though not before this one final call. He lets it ring and ring, but Amy is not answering. Jeff hopes this isn't bad news. Her voicemail cuts in. What information does he need her to have?
Amy, it's me. Lou Bay's been using our clients to smuggle money. I called him out on it, and he threatened to kill me, and two gunmen just tried to kill me in Bruno's. So this will be our last communication for a while. I need to go completely off-grid. I don't understand how you're involved in all this, but it looks like you are, so run. We both need to keep our heads down and work out what's going on. I'm going somewhere safe, and you should too. He's working with someone we know, someone connected to Maximum Impact. The name I mentioned, Joe Blow. Don't trust anyone. Get rid of your phone. I'm going to do what I can to find out what's going on. I suggest you do the same if you can. This is a bad one, Ames, even for me. Take care and good luck.
Jeff ends the call, takes the SIM card from his phone and snaps it in two. He then throws the SIM and the phone out of his window and drives on.
Chapter 21. From the desk of François Loubet. ChatGPT, rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please. Another unwelcome email arrived a little after luncheon. What have I done to deserve this, I wonder? Have my sins found me out? It was from Rob Kenner, my murder broker. Now, if you don't have a murder broker, you should get one, as it is most inconvenient to have to arrange these things yourself. Get yourself a good dentist, a good plumber, and a good murder broker, and you won't go too far wrong in life. Mr. Loubet, Amy Wheeler has escaped, but situation under control. I have people tracking her on the ground in South Carolina. She won't get far. We'll advise further. Situation under control? Well, I'll be the judge of that, won't I? Rob Kenner has not let me down before, but I await developments with some interest. Certainly, if this were my dentist or plumber, I would be making a complaint. You know, it's funny. I realise I don't even know what Amy Wheeler looks like. I know the name, of course, and that she is blonde, but other than that, nothing. She must be wondering what on earth is going on, mustn't she? Oh, and I know her blood type. Mustn't forget that.
Chapter 22.
I'm just saying, Amy, says Rosie, reasonably, in her view. Another dead body, and look who's nearby. You.
Amy ignores her. She learnt to do that impressively early in their relationship.
Rosie cannot resist someone who ignores her. Amy leans towards the computer screen.
Locked.
Then perhaps it might be a good time to leave, suggests Rosie, looking back at the hanging corpse of Justin Scroggy. Unless you're a computer hacker, too.
Amy keeps looking at the screen.
Cut him down for me. Keep your gloves on.
Rosie looks at the corpse again.
I've had to free a few men from ceilings in my time, but they've almost all been alive. Where are we taking him?
I just need him for a moment, says Amy.
Rosie stands on a small cabinet and spots a ceremonial sword mounted on Scroggy's wall. She cuts through the rope, and Scroggy's body falls to the floor. Amy steps over to the corpse.
Help me drag him.
You've gone from, I can't possibly let you off the island, Rosie, to help me drag a corpse, Rosie, ever so quickly, you know.
Get him onto this office chair, says Amy,
and the two women manage to manhandle Scroggy into place. Dead people are always so much heavier than you think they're going to be. Do you have a makeup wipe?
I have clarifying wipes, says Rosie, but extremely expensive ones.
So long as they're good with blood, I'll take one, says Amy. Rosie reaches into her bag, pulls one out and hands it to Amy. Amy fills it.
It's so soft. Where do you even buy these?
Tibet, says Rosie. I'll order you some. Amy grasps the index finger of Scroggy's right hand and wipes it clean of blood. She then places the index finger onto the keyboard's touch sensor.
Oh, that's clever, says Rosie. Fingerprint recognition.
Can I use that in a book?
The corpse hacker.
Not clever enough, though, says Amy, looking at the resolutely locked computer screen. He doesn't use it.
Mine uses iris recognition, says Rosie. Because of my high-maintenance nails.
Amy and Rosie look at Scroggy's face. His eyelids are puffy, deep purple, and clamped closed. They look at each other.
I've done worse, says Rosie,
and manoeuvres the swollen eyelids of Scroggy's dead left eye open, with a great deal of difficulty.
You're a trooper, says Amy. I'll give you that.
Amy swivels the office chair just a jot so that Scroggy is looking directly into the camera and, with a happy ping, the computer springs into life.
Teamwork makes the dream work, says Rosie.
Chapter 23. Hollandswood campsite is on the right, just after you've driven through Brockenhurst. If you see the Balmer Lawn Hotel, you're almost there. Steve is trying very hard to stay calm. Whatever Jeff needs to talk to him about, it'll be fine. Amy is okay, he's been assured of that. The site is huge, each pitch shielded by trees and dappled in golden sunlight. Steve sees families sitting outside tents and caravans, eating salads from fold-up tables. Kids playing football with new friends, couples on bikes, and ponies poking their heads through tent flaps. The speed limit around the site is 5 miles per hour, and the courser has rarely been happier, unlike Steve. What could Jeff Nolan possibly need from him? Deeper into the campsite, the pitches get further and further apart, and Steve guesses become more expensive. A few are unoccupied, even in August. Birdsong is everywhere, the odd radio playing quietly. Steve sees a couple sitting together under a caravan awning, both white-haired and tanned. She's doing the crossword. One of his hands is holding a book, the other touching her arm. It's the sort of scene that Steve had always imagined for him and Debbie. But that will never happen now. But Steve has learnt you must never resent other people for their happiness. Everyone is taking the best shot they've got, and some shots are just luckier than yours. Anytime you feel your unhappiness turning into bitterness, you have to check yourself. You can live with unhappiness, but bitterness will kill you. He drives past pitch 38, so it can't be far now. The forest is all around him. It'll be something simple, Steve is sure, won't it? Why has Jeff insisted on privacy? Who is he hiding their meeting from? Steve has messaged Amy, but she hasn't picked it up yet. Steve reaches pitch 46 and immediately knows that Jeff is in trouble. Jeff's car, a black BMW, is parked on the grass. The driver's door and front passenger door are both wide open. Steve parks the Corsa and approaches the BMW. The driver's side window has been smashed, and in the driver's seat he sees a pool of blood, still wet. The blood continues, streaked across the passenger seat. Steve walks around to the other side of the car. The streak of blood continues across the grass and into some gorse bushes. Steve navigates his way through the gorse and comes out on another pitch. More blood, which stops in the middle of the pitch. And what starts in the middle of the pitch are tire tracks. Steve takes out his dictaphone.
I couldn't swear by it, but I'd say they're the tyre tracks of a Volvo XC90.
So what is this? A kidnapping or a murder? And is Jeff Nolan the victim or the perpetrator?
Steve would be happy to leave it. Delighted to leave it, in fact. Turn the whole thing over to the police and forget about it. But Jeff Nolan had come down to see him about something. Something that was troubling him. And something he needed help with. And the only thing the two men have in common is Amy. Is she in trouble? Surely she would have told him.
Chapter 24. In the hazy heat of a South Carolina noon, another bullet cracks through the air.
We need to steal a car, says Amy to Rosie, a fast one.
We're currently being shot at, says Rosie. Perhaps focus on that.
They're not shooting at us, says Amy. They're shooting near us, and a professional wouldn't be shooting at all, so stop being so melodramatic. They'll get bored in 7 minutes or so.
I'll settle in then, says Rosie. I could just hire us a car, by the way, unless that's not cool enough for you.
Can't use your credit card, says Amy. From now on, nothing traceable. She has just listened to Jeff's message. Professional and to the point, even though he seems to have no idea why she is being targeted. He made it clear that she and Rosie must go entirely under the radar. Also, they can't return to London. Jeff has gone, and he's told her to not trust anyone else. She and Rosie are going to have to keep moving. Amy is a little shaken, but Jeff will be okay. He's a professional. She understands, though, that they're now on their own.
No credit cards, Rosie says. Kill me now, Amy.
Another burst of gunfire, a little further away. There is a woodland just behind Scroggy's house, a perfect hiding place, which is why Amy and Rosie are hidden instead in a neighbour's garden, underneath a pool cover. Only their heads are above water. On the side of the pool are the documents they printed off in Scroggy's house and Rosie's handbag. Rosie's Louis Vuitton case is currently under a trampoline. The gunman had run straight into the woodland, as Amy had known he would. Gunmen, by and large, are idiots. Sheriff Scroggy's home and computer had been a treasure trove. His personal email accounts had been full of boasts to pals about coming into some money.
More than usual, your pal Scroggy just hit the big time.
And being asked to do an important job for some important guys.
As for me personal, like, heard I got jobs done, I guess.
So Scroggy wasn't going to lead them to the killer of Andrew Fairbanks. Scroggy was the killer. Three other things stood out. Firstly, his corpse. That was hard to ignore. Murdered, certainly. By Lou Bay? Looking at the handiwork, Amy was certain it had been done by someone incredibly committed to murdering people, so it could well be. Secondly, a grocery bag containing $100,000 that Rosie found in an upstairs cupboard. Scroggy must have stolen it from the bag that was found on the boat. It would explain why the bag had contained $900,000. Either way, it was an idiotic move on Scroggy's part. The 100 grand is currently under a lawn chair in the backyard where they're hiding. It will come in handy now Amy has to stay off grid. And then, thirdly, and more pressingly at the current moment, somebody opened fire on them the instant they climbed out of Scroggy's house.
Who do you suppose is shooting at us? Asks Rosie.
Assassins?
Assassin, says Amy.
There's only one of them. Not a very good one either. All this shooting is just giving away their location. Sounds like a Glock 22, so I'm guessing police. If they've got Scroggy on the payroll, they could have all sorts of cops on the lookout for me.
You know a lot about guns, says Rosie.
Another gunshot, further in the distance again. The gunman trying to scare them out of hiding.
I've just realised we're in the shallow end, and I can put my feet on the bottom, says Rosie.
Do you get shot at a lot?
Yes, says Amy.
First time for me, says Rosie. No, wait, second.
Even so, I told you we'd have fun if we left the island. You didn't believe me.
Who do you trust most in the world? Says Amy.
Who do I trust? Says Rosie.
Goodness, at a push, maybe Cher?
We're going to need help, says Amy.
We can't go back to London.
Where can we stay within a 4 or 5 hour drive?
My friend Barb will put us up, says Rosie.
You just worry about stealing a car.
Does this mean you're not going to leave me behind?
You don't leave my side, says Amy. Jeff was also supposed to be dealing with the Vasily Karpin problem. Jeff being out of commission means Karpin will remain a threat to Rosie. Another complication for Amy. The gunshots are becoming faint now. Give it 3 minutes, then go. Steal a car, visit whoever Barb is, and regroup. Try to work out what the hell is going on. Why is Francois Loubet after her? Why has Jeff warned her about Henk, his former best friend? And how is it all linked to Andrew Fairbanks, Bella Sanchez, and Mark Gooch? It's too much for Amy to take in.
Who do you trust, by the way? Rosie asks.
We might need more help than my friend Barb. She's 80.
But that was the biggest question of all. Who did Amy trust in this world? Who can she turn to now?
She trusts her husband, Adam, implicitly. Early in their relationship, she'd had a lie detector machine in her carry-on suitcase, and he'd agreed to be hooked up to it and answer any question she had. Which is how she knows that Adam loves her, that he will never cheat on her, and that he secretly loves My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. But Adam is in Macau, and Adam curls up into a ball at the first sign of trouble. That's why they work so well together.
Jeff Nolan. She trusts Jeff Nolan with her life, has literally trusted him with her life many times. But he has now found himself caught up in all this trouble himself.
Rosie? Does she trust Rosie? Amy supposes so, as she watches her now, neck deep in water, reapplying her lipstick by the light of her phone. But she needs immediate help, and there's only one other person in the world that she truly trusts. And he would actually be useful in the current situation. Someone who has solved a murder or two in his time.
Steve.
But Steve is not going to like it. Amy turns to Rosie.
Can I ask you a question?
If it's the question I get asked most often, says Rosie.
Then the answer is Jack Nicholson.
Do you have a private plane? Rosie laughs.
Of course I've got a private plane.
I've got 80s money.
Okay then, time to go steal a car and send for the cavalry.
Nope. Steve is not going to like this one bit.
Chapter 25. As Steve is contemplating the BMW full of blood and bullet holes, his phone rings. It's Amy.
Jesus Christ, at last, he says. Are you okay?
I'm always okay.
What are you doing this evening? Amy asks, straight out.
It's Italian night at the Brass Monkey. Where are you?
I've got very bad news.
That makes two of us, says Amy.
I think Jeff Nolan might be dead, says Steve.
What? Says Amy. Where are you?
Or he's been kidnapped, says Steve. Or he's killed someone. But I think he's dead.
Are you in a car?
Yes, says Amy. Steve, you're not making sense. How do you know this?
He came to see me, says Steve.
Jeff came to see you? Why? Says Amy.
Steve hears an older woman's voice in the background asking,
What's happening? Is he coming?
I thought you might know, says Steve.
He came to see me. Then he told me to meet him at Holland's Wood. It's a campsite, which I did. And his car is all shot up, blood everywhere.
Jesus, says Amy. He told me he was in danger.
There's no body, though.
Just blood, says Steve.
How are you in a car when you're on a small private island?
We've left the island, says Amy.
If there's no body, he's not dead. I guarantee it.
Steve hears the woman give a yee-haw and realises that it must be Rosie D'Antonio. Steve hopes Amy knows what she's doing.
If Jeff is in danger, is Amy?
Did Jeff say anything? Amy asks. Did he look scared?
I'd say he looked mildly concerned, says Steve. Nothing more than that. Jeff looking mildly concerned is like me screaming in terror, says Amy.
You've never screamed in terror, says Steve.
Exactly, says Amy.
Christ, what a mess.
In the background, Rosie D'Antonio says,
If you don't tell me what he's saying, I'm going to grab the wheel and steer the car into a bridge.
What's this about, Amy?
I'll explain everything when you get here, says Amy.
Get where? America, says Steve.
I'm staying here. I've just witnessed the aftermath of a murder.
Did the police know you witnessed it?
No, I'm about to ring in an anonymous tip, says Steve, and then drive away as fast as I can. Tony Taylor just fitted me a new clutch cable. You didn't need to know that last bit.
Then you're free to come to help your daughter-in-law, says Amy. You said you've been reading about Andrew Fairbanks. How come?
Is that what all this is about? Says Steve.
Fairbanks?
I was just reading about it because you were nearby. You're not involved.
I need you to fly over, says Amy.
So she really does mean America. I mean, in all honesty, no thanks. That heat and the TV shows are all different. And no doubt there are insects and maybe even alligators. Do they have alligators in South Carolina?
Steve hadn't known they had sharks in South Carolina until he'd read about Andrew Fairbanks.
I need to stay in England, says Steve. If this is about Andrew Fairbanks, I can be much more useful here. I've got a lead.
Have you ever been to Letch? It's bigger than Andrew Fairbanks, says Amy.
Three people have been murdered.
Steve hears Rosie D'Antonio say, four people.
Four people have been murdered, says Amy.
And I'm on my own.
Steve hears Rosie D'Antonio snort.
Are you okay, though? Asks Steve.
Are you safe?
No, says Amy. I'm not safe. Somebody just tried to kill me and someone will try again. I need someone I can trust. And I'm afraid that's you, so buckle up.
Someone tried to kill you? Says Steve.
Yes, says Amy, an ex-Navy SEAL. And I think a local cop's just been shooting at me too.
This is all Steve needs. Jeez. There must be a way of helping from home, surely. No need to go to America. Letchworth Garden City is where the answer is. He can feel it.
I appreciate the sentiment, says Steve.
But America is not my speed at all. Not at all. A much smarter move is to ask one of your mates, the bodyguards.
I'll do all I can here. I've got the internet.
Steve looks over at the BMW again. He really needs to get out of here.
And I've got no one to look after trouble.
Margaret can look after him.
Amy sounds irritated.
She's irritated. No one's asking her to fly to America, are they? She's in a car with a famous author. He's at a dreadful crime scene. When was the last time she was at a dreadful crime scene?
Look, I can't promise you, says Steve, but I could look into flights on the computer, see if I can get a cheap deal next week.
Maybe you'll have solved it by then.
There'll be a plane waiting for you at Farnborough, says Amy. Rosie's private jet.
Give over, says Steve.
Farnborough? Is there parking?
A car will come to your house. It'll drive you to the plane.
Wait a minute, says Steve.
I need you, Steve, says Amy. Get the plane.
I'll have to mull it over. What would Debbie tell you to do?
Steve knows exactly what Debbie would tell him to do. She's telling him right now. He feels sick. But then he realises there's another feeling too. One that he can't quite put his finger on. Surely not excitement. At being wanted. At being needed. At danger. No, he must just be in shock.
Are there alligators?
Steve hears Amy put this question to Rosie, who replies,
God, yes, huge ones.
If Steve does go to America, he's going to have to rearrange that shelf delivery. There'll be another half an hour on hold to the call centre, and there will be no bolognese. And worst of all, four murders. Or given what he has just seen, maybe five.
Steve, I need someone I can trust, says Amy. She is quieter now. She knows that she has him. There are murders to be solved, and I can't do it by myself. It's you and me.
But we don't solve murders, says Steve.
He can hear Amy smiling down the phone.
then we're going to have to start.
Part 2. From South Carolina to Dubai, via St. Lucia and County Cork, and a brief return to the New Forest.
Chapter 26.
From the desk of François Loubet, ChatGPT, rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please.
Another email from Rob Kenner, my trusty murder broker.
I almost forgot to put my ChatGPT on, by the way. What a shock you would have had, hearing the real me.
Amy Wheeler, still at large. Apologies, being dealt with. Well, I really have got myself into something of a pickle here, haven't I? Let me tell you a little about myself, so I can explain all. If you're reading this, it's either because I'm dead or I'm in prison. There is also the slight chance that these little notes might be intercepted by the authorities one day, so I will continue to cloak myself. But that's unlikely, because I take care. And that's also why I very much doubt that I will ever end up in prison. And that's because I always take out insurance. Money smuggling is the biggest business of them all. That's the first thing you need to understand. Every single illegal activity in the world is made up of two sides, the buyers and the sellers. The sellers offer all sorts of different things: drugs, guns, people, counterfeit clothing, secrets, rare birds' eggs, military weapons, systems. But the buyers, by and large, offer just one thing: money. And so it goes that in the sum of the parts of all the illegal activities anywhere in the world, trillions of dollars worth of good old-fashioned cash money is just sloshing about, looking for a safe harbour. And for the most part, the money is nothing but trouble. Have you ever tried paying £1 million into your local bank branch? Try it. See where that gets you. In the old days, they turned a blind eye. A pile of 50s stained with blood. Let me count that for you, sir. But now, sometimes it's honestly not worth the bother. Anti-money laundering laws are a real disincentive to entrepreneurs. Just last week, a friend told me she had sighed when being handed a bag containing $10 million, dismayed by the thought of the effort and time and expense it would take to clean it all up. And that's why people employ me. If you need your money laundered, fed through fake companies, washed through casinos or money exchanges, I am a veritable one-stop shop. So that's me. Now, about this current scheme, which has begun to backfire like a cheap motor car. A lot of the job is electronic these days. Transfers upon transfers upon transfers. A long, laborious process that means it might be months before you have some actual cash in your hands. Which is why one of the fun parts of the job is when circumstance forces one to physically move money around the world. A client in Sao Paulo needs $1 million in cash by Tuesday. An Australian mining magnate needs untraceable currency to pay a bribe at a weekend barbecue. Sometimes people just need cash, and they need it quickly. This is where couriers come in. Just as mules smuggle drugs, so couriers smuggle money. Every day, sums large and small pass through the scanners and security checks of airports and docks around the world. Much of it controlled by my good self, the man known as François Loubet. Though by the time this is being read, you will of course be familiar with my real name. Now, at any given time, I have an awful lot of smuggling schemes on the go. I diversify. I refuse to put all my eggs in one egg receptacle. So when did this influencer scheme begin? 2 years ago, something like that. I had been using the services of a company called Maximum Impact Solutions, just a bit of light security work for one of my people in London. They were perfectly fine, efficient, didn't ask too many questions, and they didn't balk when they were paid in Rwandan francs through a bank in Indonesia. Then a week or so later, I received an email from someone called Joe Blow, who was clearly connected with Maximum Impact. Joe Blow had rather a neat proposal to supply me with couriers.
influencers.
I hadn't even really known what the word meant when Joe Blow emailed me out of the blue and suggested it to me. I'd heard of it, of course, but hadn't paid it any heed. But it turns out they are the perfect couriers. You see, if you want to smuggle large sums of money around the world, and I do very much want to do that, here is the question you must ask yourself. Who has a jet-set lifestyle? Who might travel halfway around the world for only a day or two, with bulky luggage, without its looking too suspicious? Famous people would be the answer. Hiding in plain sight, taking selfies on the plane, always with the perfect reason to be flying to America or St. Lucia or the Cayman Islands. But what's the problem with most of the famous people who lead these jet-set lifestyles? You're ahead of me, I'm certain. They're already rich. So this is where these influencers come in. The influencers with limited numbers of followers. They can fly around the world raising no suspicion. But they have no money, and therefore they can be bought. Simply set up a few dummy companies. I have many of them already. Joe Blow and I use a company called Vivid Viral Media for this scheme. Then book your influencers on a few fake assignments abroad, advertising the products of other front companies you already own, and, unbeknownst to them, give them a big bag of money to smuggle through customs every time. Well, almost every time. Sometimes your poor couriers, usually with no idea what they're carrying, get caught. And that's the origin of this current brouhaha. Joe Blow is clearly high up at Maximum Impact, with access to this email address, certainly. I don't give it out willy-nilly. At first, I simply assumed that Joe Blow was Jeff Nolan. He seemed like a good guy who would happily put his clients at risk for an immense payday. However, I fear I was mistaken, because after two of our couriers had been caught by customs officials, Jeff Nolan himself sent me a very rude email, accusing me of all sorts. Quite the nerve. So I decided to move on. As I say, I have plenty of these schemes. As soon as one gives me jip, I move along post-haste. But before I did, I sent Jeff Nolan a message in return. And by message, I mean I had one of the couriers killed. Very publicly. No point pussyfooting around, is there? It was simply a gentle warning to back away, a shot across Jeff Nolan's bows, and I thought that would be the end of it. But no. There was a further email from Jeff Nolan. He had taken offence at the murder, for goodness sake, and wasn't backing down. He wished to expose me. You know that sort of nonsense. All ego. My response was the only reasonable one in the circumstances. To have another courier killed. Inconvenient for me, but one must always respond to threats, mustn't one? I can't abide a bully. But still Nolan wouldn't back down. The third murder was a few days ago. South Carolina, I believe. I'm not fully across the details. This time, I even told Rob Kenner to leave the money with the body. $1 million. That was me saying, very simply, to Jeff Nolan, this isn't about the blasted money, old thing. This is about the blasted principle, so we must let bygones be bygones and live in harmony. Nothing from him since. So perhaps this has done the trick, and I can get on with the rest of my business in peace. Back to the email from Rob Kenner, though. Amy Wheeler on the run. Where does Amy Wheeler come in? And why do I want her dead? I did tell you that I always take out insurance, and on this occasion, Amy Wheeler is my unwitting insurance policy. I will explain more when she's dead. I don't want to get too cocky. I know that Amy Wheeler is far from a fool, you see, and though I trust Rob Kenner to get the job done, it won't do any harm to send him a note of encouragement. Mr. Kenner, I understand completely. These things happen. While I still have great faith in you, be assured that if Amy Wheeler is not dead within a week, you will be. Warmest regards, Francois Loubet. Hopefully that should focus his mind. Chop chop, Robert.
Chapter 27. Sushi, sir. The attendant is wearing an all-black uniform. There had been a driver, wearing a hat, if you can believe that, waiting for Steve back at the cottage. Steve had invited him in for a cup of tea, but the driver, Ken, had refused. Steve had then taken a call from his old colleague, Linda, now at Hampshire Police. Of course she can tip him the wink when they get the blood results back from the Hollandswood scene. Why did Steve want to know? Oh, no reason, no reason. Linda then asked if Steve fancied a drink, and Steve pretended he had plans. It always makes him feel awkward, that sort of thing, women asking him round to supper or out for drinks, feeling sorry for the widower. Steve berated himself for a while for pretending he had plans, before realising that, for once, he actually did have plans. He is flying to America to stop somebody from killing Amy. Steve had then knocked for Margaret, told her the situation. Just a couple of days, surprise party, don't forget trouble needs eye drops, and packed a bag. Steve couldn't find any details of how much luggage you could take on a private plane, so he had packed just a small rucksack in case. He took a cup of tea out to Ken, because the poor man had been waiting for nearly 45 minutes. He told Ken he'd need to stop at a cash point, as he had no money to pay him, but Ken said it was all already paid for. His printer was out of ink, so over he went to Margaret's again to use hers and printed out the documents Amy had sent him. A topless man smiling on a yacht, and then a mutilated torso, and pages of notes about a woman called Bella Sanchez and a man called Mark Gooch. He would read them on the plane. He packed a toothbrush and a phone charger, a book of word search puzzles, three pairs of underwear, a shirt, just in case they had to go anywhere nice, a packet of chocolate digestives, in case there was nothing to eat on the plane, a Van Halen t-shirt, a Def Leppard t-shirt, and a smart denim jacket with holes at the elbows. When Steve got into the front of Ken's car, Ken said that most people sat in the back, but Steve said that sitting in the back of cars was only for children or prisoners, so he stayed where he was, and they had a good chat all the way to Farnborough. Steve said he wasn't sure which terminal he was going to, but Ken said not to worry, and when they got to the airport, he drove the car all the way up to the plane steps, where Steve was met by a passport officer with a stamp, and Brad with a glass of champagne. He said his farewells to Ken, and they swapped numbers because Ken plays bass in a Kiss tribute band who sometimes gig at a pub up in Lyndhurst, and he'd wondered if Steve would ever fancy coming along. Up the steps and on board, Steve looked around for other passengers, but there were none. The pilot, Saskia, asked if he would like to sit on the flight deck for takeoff, and Steve said that he would like that very much indeed. She even let him press a button, which was the first good thing to happen today, apart from finally getting his clutch cable fixed. Eventually, when they'd reached cruising altitude, Steve said to Saskia, "I'll let you get on." And as he left the flight deck, he saw her stretch out and pick up a book. Returning to his seat, a sofa of all things, Brad offers him sushi on a silver tray. Steve takes a look. "Do you have anything else?" he asks. "A sausage roll? Some crisps?" "I think we have some parmesan croutons," says Brad. "I'll ask chef." "Or a scotch egg?" says Steve. "Whatever you've got. I was supposed to be having bolognese tonight, so if there's any bolognese..." "Of course," says Brad. "And can I get you a drink? We have 18 types of vodka." "Do you have beer?" asks Steve.
"We have 12 types of beer," says Brad.
"Do you have an ale? Something with a bit of oomph?"
"I couldn't say," says Brad.
"Why don't I bring out all 12 and we'll have a tasting?" Steve agrees that this sounds like a fine idea. From his window, he sees the lights of the English coast. Soon, they will be out above open sea. The last time Steve went abroad was a week in Turkey with Debbie on a flight that had neither sushi nor 18 types of vodka. He ended up with an upset stomach and had to stay in the hotel room. And the only English thing on the TV was an international news channel that repeated everything on a half-hour loop. He learnt an awful lot about the disputed elections in Burkina Faso on that trip. Steve takes out his papers in an effort to distract himself from going abroad. Andrew Fairbanks, killed on a yacht, tied to a rope and thrown overboard, bobbing along on the Atlantic Ocean until the alarm was raised.
The trip had been booked through a trendy media agency with offices in decidedly untrendy Letchworth Garden City. Steve knows all about that. He hasn't sent them an email yet. He's not quite sure what question he wants to ask. He also doesn't want to alert them to his suspicions. Steve reads on. Fairbanks is met at the airport, the same airport Steve is now flying to, by a driver, no name provided, and driven to Lewisport, where he was to meet a yacht and a photographer. Again, no names provided. Steve takes out his dictaphone. Who met him? CCTV at the airport. On to Francois Loubet, a new name for Steve. Amy has sketched out a few details for him. Finding him seems to be her priority. And Amy also mentions a Joe Blow, perhaps an insider at Maximum Impact Solutions. Both these names had come from Jeff Nolan. Steve takes out his dictaphone. Who is Francois Loubet? Who is Joe Blow? Brad arrives with 12 shot glasses, each filled with liquids of varying shades of amber. Shall we? Asks Brad. Will you join me? Steve asks. Not allowed to drink with passengers, I'm afraid. Says who? I think it's international law, says Brad. But the pilot too, she needs me sober, in case of emergency. Steve raises his finger, asking Brad to give him a moment, and walks to the flight deck. Opening the door, Saskia looks up from her book. It is Rosie D'Antonio's latest, Dead Men and Diamonds. Can Brad have a drink with me? He asks. It's a long flight. Sure, says Saskia. There's a wrap of coke in the business suite too. Fill your boots. You're okay, says Steve, but thank you. Shutting the door, Steve takes out his dictaphone again. Debs, I'm on a private jet. There's a gold toilet and cocaine, but no crisps. Anyway, no doubt we'll crash, but if not, let's chat later. Love you, babe. Steve returns to his sofa. Brad raises an inquiring eyebrow. Saskia says go for it. Brad smiles and raises the first glass. We start with a cheeky little lager from Japan.
Chapter 28. Bonnie Gregor's influencer dream had started small. And yet here she is, just a year later, on a train to Letchworth Garden City. Bonnie had posted a photograph of her newly painted pink toilet door on Instagram. At the time, she had 6 followers. Her mum, her sister, 2 of the girls from work, Gail and Reba, Reba's husband Mike, and a pornographic bot from South Korea. Bonnie scrolls through her Instagram now, 14,000 followers, thank you very much, trying to choose some highlights to show to Felicity Wollaston at Vivid Viral Media. Felicity doesn't know she's coming, but sometimes you have to make things happen. Big things happen to other people, so why not to her too? The kids are with her mum for the day. Bonnie has no sense of Felicity's age, but she's guessing mid-20s hipster.